Welcome to the How Did They Do It Real Estate Podcast. Have you ever wondered how people succeed in real estate and what steps they took to get there? If so, this podcast is for you. Your hosts, Sayla and Eileen Prack, interview top experts in the real estate community to share with you their real estate journey and how they achieved massive success. Our goal is to provide you with valuable real estate resources and to help you apply it to your own real estate goal. Welcome to today's episode of the How Did They Do It Real Estate Podcast. I'm your host, Eileen Prack. And today our guest is Joseph Vinerin, and he is an experienced and active real estate investor located in New York. His main focus has been investing in towns that are up and coming due to their proximity within the Big Apple. His focus is 50% buy and hold and 50% flipping. And for Joe, every property is different, and he believes in looking at real estate for what is at its highest and best use, while also keeping in mind how much time something takes. He's been in the industry for over 11 years and has been involved in over 100 real estate transactions. So, Joe, welcome to the show. Thank you so much for being here.
Yeah, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
All right, Joe, can you please share a little bit more about your background and how did you get started with real estate?
Sure. I got started in 2012 or 2011, I believe. Maybe 2012. I think I bought my first property and the market was very low. I don't know. How was it where you are in San Diego?
They were still come up and coming at that time, and they were still getting competitive, but not as competitive as it was today. You were still able to afford some houses, but you could still see the prices of the housing continue to go up like all the time.
Yeah. Well, about where I was, it was like after the crash, 2008, I think was the crash, 2009, in that area. So there was a tons of foreclosures. I'm about an hour and 15 minutes from Manhattan, and you could buy houses for 60, 70, 80 grand. It was very cheap. You could get places. I mean, 80 grand then is like 160 grand now, but still, it's still cheap, relatively. And my parents were in real estate a bit. My mom was in real estate. She had a few rentals actually in the area. So I grew up around it. I used to have to go with her on weekends and maybe help paint the inside of the house when I was like 10 years old. And I hated it. I wasn't very useful, but I would kind of learn the business a bit. You know, this is the way to create wealth. You can make a good living. She taught me a few tricks. Obviously, I went much farther than her. You know, she didn't have that experience from a young age or her mother teaching her. So I kind of grew up around it. They didn't have millions and millions of dollars in a big portfolio. They had a few two-family houses that were on the cheaper side. You could rent them out for $1,200 or $1,300 a month at that time, or maybe $1,000. Now it's much more, but that's how I got kind of started. It was already implemented in my life somewhat. And 2012, I saw a house very cheap, and me and my mom split it. I think I saved up like $30,000 or $40,000. The house was $60,000. It needed some work, not a whole lot. It needed mostly cosmetic painting and some other things. And I bought the house for $61,000, I think, and then I sold it the next year for $140,000. It was a three unit, actually. And then I just kept the ball rolling. I was buying houses $50,000, $60,000, and the market really started going up in my area 2016, 2017. And then when COVID hit, it just really took off, because remember, a lot of people lost family members, you know, maybe their father, their aunt, you know, some people, their husband and wife from COVID in New York City. That was the epicenter. They said, we don't want to live in close quarters anymore. Let's move to the suburbs. So from 2020, 2021 to now, the prices have tripled maybe. You can get a house before for maybe $200,000, something okay, not new, but not that old, but livable. Now that same house is $450,000, $500,000.
So when you bought that first house, that 61,000, that was a triplex, you said? There was three units there?
Yeah, it was three units, but it was only a legal two family. I lived in one unit and then rented out the other two. I thought it was a legal three family, but it wasn't. But I still sold the property later. So it was my first deal.
Got it. So then at that time, were you planning to hold it for a long-term rentals, or what made you decide it to sell it the next year instead of continuing to hold it as a long-term rental?
You know, I didn't have funding and financing and things like that. I didn't know how to crack the code of how do I get a loan or how do I do this? I was like, well, I need money to buy the next one and I can make money here. So I'll sell it and make a profit and buy the next one. I didn't understand the rental game. I didn't even know what a cap rate was. I was new. I just figured this is a cheap house. This is a good deal. I think I can fix it and sell it for more. I had no investment strategy, to be honest.
So how much renovation did you have to put into that?
Maybe about 30,000 or so, but I also rented it out for a year. I kept it for a year and then I sold it. And I think I did that so I wouldn't have to pay as much capital gains on it. That was my strategy. And then I was learning all these things as I go, and I found out, well, if you live in the residence for up 2 years, then you don't have to pay the capital gains as your primary residence. But even if you live in it for 1 year, I guess that capital gain tax is prorated. So you would just pay less, or I think it's something that the first $250,000 of capital gains, if it's your primary residence, you're allowed to write off. You don't have to pay tax on. I'm not an accountant. But so if you hold it for 1 year and live in it for 1 year, there would only be, you can write off $125,000 of gains. It's your primary residence if you live there.
So then you sold that property and then made a nice profit off of there. And then did you roll everything into the next property, or what happened after that? Did you buy multiple properties with the capital gains that you made off of that first property?
Yeah, I bought one for 30 and then I bought another one for 40 and then I sold those. And then I think I bought one for 57, rented it out for a little bit, sold that. I was just buying, selling, renting for a year, then sell it. I didn't really have a strategy. And then about 2015, after being for 3 years, I said, what am I doing? The houses that I sold went up in value. I didn't have to sell them and buy others. I could have just taken out a loan against it. I started thinking about more investing. I started thinking, if I keep buying and selling, how am I going to retire? I need steady cash flow. And at the same time, I read that book, Rich Dad, Poor Dad, and it talks about cash flow. And I said, look, I have to start holding some property for cash flow.
So during that time when you were buying, you mentioned you didn't really have a strategy, but what were you looking for when you were looking for different properties to purchase? And then what numbers made sense to you? Like what attracted you to want to purchase those properties that you ended up buying?
Just the price. It was like 55 grand, 50 grand, 62,000. I said, I couldn't build it for that. No, but this is so cheap. You know, I have to. And I think the rent was, so I bought a house for 60 grand and I put 20 grand into it. And I was getting 1400 a month rent. So I think the cap rate was pretty decent, like a 12 or 13% return. That was after a few deals.
So
I just looked at the cap rate on later in the deals.
Got it. So then were you at that time when you were putting some tenants in there as well, were you all managing all this on your own, or did you have a property manager to help place tenants and manage the day-to-day?
No, I still do all the property managing now, believe it or not. I have different systems. They pay electronically. But I pick my tenants. I'm very, I don't want to say strict, but I pick the right person. So I have a talk with the tenants. I say, it's my house, but it's your home. So don't call me for light bulbs. Don't call me because the toilet handle is jiggling or the toilet handle broke. Don't call me because the doorknob's loose. These are things you have to take care of on your own. If there's no heat, give me a call. And then I simply just call this plumber that I know to go over and fix it. He mails me the bill. But I tell him, look, this is not Trump Towers. This is not the Ritz-Carlton. I offer a good product at a competitive price. My places are decent, clean. They're updated, but they're not luxury buildings. So this has kept the calls down. I kind of have a talk with them, whoever I rent to. And I typically try to rent to somebody, you know, I ask them these questions, but I try to, maybe somebody that's a little handy. Not all the time, but, you know, I ask them, do you know how to use a screwdriver? If the doorknob's loose? Yeah. If they're going to be calling about loose doorknobs or the toilet handle's broken, I don't want them as a tenant.
So then after you bought a couple of properties, you mentioned that you were buying, renting them for a year or so, and then selling them pretty shortly after that. Then you read Rich Dad, Poor Dad, and then your strategy changed. You started focusing on cash flow. Can you share a little bit of what that looked like after you made that shift?
Yeah, I mean, I was fixing up and then renting them out long-term, and I was looking for long-term tenants that were self-sufficient. I would say, look, I am the landlord, but I'm not your mother. And they kind of laugh about it, but they get it. You kind of set the rules before they move in. You could have somebody with a great credit score and a great job, but if they're expecting like very luxury and a high level of service, you don't really want those people either. You want somebody who's reasonable, who, oh, I'll just do that myself a lot. I don't want to bother the landlord. That's the kind of mentality I'm looking for, where, oh, I'll bother him if it's an emergency. Somebody reasonable, where they treat it like it's their home, and they only call if there's something pretty drastic, or, but not for every little thing.
So then now do you hold on to your properties long-term or are you still buying and selling?
It depends. So New York is very high property taxes. I don't know about California. How are they there?
Yes, high property taxes as well.
Yeah, it depends on the property. So properties that tend to have more land or I can see a homeowner wanting to live there with their family, I tend to fix up and sell. Because the amount of rent that you get more rent, but it's dollar to dollar compared to the price that you could sell it for, it just doesn't make sense. And plus, if they don't mow the lawn, then you have to send a landscaper out there. If they, you know, you have to deal with, oh, there's snow on the driveway, bigger houses, things like that. I tend to sell. There's more components that can go wrong. I try to keep the two families, the three families. Some of the single families, maybe if it's in a bad area, I will keep it because you're not going to get that much money selling it. Townhouses, I love, as long as they have no HOA. There's minimal maintenance. You're only dealing with two exposed walls, the front and the back, and the roof is flat. There isn't much that can go wrong on the outside. And you can get pretty good money renting them out. And that's kind of been my strategy. Multi-families I keep and single families that have lower maintenance, lower taxes, or maybe they're in a bad area and I can't get that much money if I sell it, but I can rent it out decent still.
So are you still focused in the same market or do you expand to different markets as well?
No, I'm still in the same market. So I'm trying to get maybe, if I can get, I think there's like a threshold, 50 or 60 units in one area, then you can attract a different type of buyer, they say. Maybe not an institutional investor, but you can attract somebody that buys the whole thing and they'll pay a premium for it, and they'll buy it at like a 6 or 7% return, or maybe even 5%, just because they're buying so many units within a few mile radius.
So more of like a portfolio type of strategy.
Yeah, portfolio. So I noticed, if you want to buy an apartment building, whoever owns these buildings, they're usually pretty experienced in real estate, and it's like hard to make money on them. I'm like, they're asking this much for this. This is a 5% return only. How am I going to make money on this? What do I do? So I'm kind of just getting a lot of two families, single families, three families within a couple miles of each other. And then I can offer a package of 40 units between maybe 13 properties. It's not as lucrative for a big time investor because you have 13 addresses. But I offer a better cap rate than the apartment building, they will buy it, I think.
So, Joe, what's next for you? What are you focused on next?
Next for me, I've been selling some stuff right now. I think a little differently. A lot of people think about the return on their investment cap rate. Do the listeners know what a cap rate means?
Yes,
maybe some of them.
Yeah, you can get into a little bit of high overview of the cap rate.
Okay. Cap rate is the return you get per year after all your expenses, percentage wise. But I think the bank is paying about 5% right now, interest, just on my Chase account's paying 4.7, and Chase is a strong bank. There was a couple banks that, you know, collapsed over the summer, but Chase isn't going anywhere. And they're paying 4.7% on the liquid account, not a CD, not any of that. So when I buy a property and I fix it up, I kind of evaluate my cap rate at not what I'm in it for, but what I could sell it for. So I might be in a property after I fix it up, 500 grand, let's say. But meanwhile, I have no debt on this property. If you have debt, that's a different story because you're paying down the mortgage and you're gaining equity. But if you have any property with no debt, if you have 500 grand there and you're clearing, let's say, a 5% cap rate, 25 grand a year would be after all your expenses, it doesn't really make sense to keep it. I'd rather just sell it and put my money in the bank and collect the interest until I find something else to trade up to. Remember, things get used up over time. There's service calls, there's this, there's that, the unknown. Even if the tenants pay the rent every time, eventually things get used up. So, I mean, what you could say is I don't really bet on the appreciation. That's just a bonus.
And how has real estate investing impacted your life?
How's it impacted? I mean, it gave me a lot of freedom. I travel a lot. I have a few different vehicles. It's gave me everything that I have. This is what I do full time. And I'm not a real estate agent or anything.
And if there's one thing you know now about real estate that you wish you knew when you first started, what would that be?
I would say you got to think of it as your dollar per hour. So I hear new investors, they take on this big project. Maybe they get a good deal and they go, I'm going to fix it all up and I'll make $90,000. But maybe they could just sell it the way it is for $50,000 or $60,000 and move on. Is all that work worth the extra $30,000? If you have to put in so much work into it, think about it like dollar per hour, not the amount of money you're going to make. Think about the amount of money you're going to make per hour on the deal. You will make more, but time is very valuable. It's the most valuable thing they say. So if it takes you 6 months to do that, you make a little bit more money, it's not worth it. The opportunity cost. We're only going to live so long. So you have to keep that money moving as fast as you can, you know, to eventually buy some rentals and get that financial freedom you want.
And what is the one thing that sets successful people apart in real estate investing?
The one thing I would say, if they keep property, I know a lot of, they call themselves real estate investors, but they're builders. A builder is not an investor. A lot of builders I know don't know much about investing. They're marketing people. They're selling a home, a dream, but they don't know returns or percentages or cap rates, or they don't understand the way investors think or cash flow. They're building a new house and they sell it to a family. That's not investing. That's selling a retail product.
So, Joe, where can our listeners find out more about you and what you're doing?
I'm on Instagram, and my Instagram is the Casa Investor, like Casa in Spanish, and it's with no numbers, just the Casa Investor.
Fantastic. Joe, thank you so much for all of your time today. I appreciate it.
All right, thank you. I hope you got some value out of me, and I appreciate you having me on the podcast.
Thank you, Joe. Appreciate you.
Take care.
And thank you for listening to our podcast today, brought to you by Bonavest Capital. We would really appreciate it if you can go to iTunes right now and leave a rating and written review. Also, please don't forget to subscribe so you can always get the latest episodes. You can also connect with us on Facebook, How Did They Do It Real Estate. We'd love to hear your feedback and any topics that you're interested in for future episodes. If you're anything like Zayla and me and believe that real estate investing is a great way to create passive income and build long-term wealth, check out our free apartment syndication due diligence checklist for passive investors at bonavestcapital.com/checklist. Zayla and I created this checklist for ourselves as we evaluated different multifamily syndication opportunities as a passive investor. So we would love to share it with you so you can use it as a resource as well. Download your free copy today at bonavestcapital.com/checklist. Lastly, to learn more about us, you can go to bonavestcapital.com and fill out the contact us page so you can speak to us directly. Nothing on the show should be considered as specific personal advice. Please consult your legal, tax, and real estate professionals for individualized advice.